This is Gil Manser. Welcome you to the May 2016 edition of Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media KRCB-FM. Today's guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, best-selling novelist, and social commentator Anna Quinlan with her newest novel, Miller's Valley. Anna Quinlan, I want to welcome you to Word by Word.
Thanks, Gil.
Now, Miller's Valley is set in a small rural community in the 1960s when the town's very existence is threatened by becoming the site of a federal water project reservoir. In time, only the top of the church steeple will poke above the water. So I was looking up where you live and all the background bio information, and I found that you have a place called Cherry Valley, Pennsylvania, which is a national wildlife refuge. And I'm wondering if there's a synchronicity of things there.
There's not really.
Really?
I mean, I know everybody always looks for autobiography in your work when you're a fiction writer. And I think probably for your first novel, they're right to look there. And I will say that not too far from where our place is in Pennsylvania, there was once an abortive project called the Tox Island Dam on the Delaware River between New Jersey and Pennsylvania. There was a plan to build a dam there, and there was a move to move a lot of people who lived in an area called Tox Island. Ultimately, they didn't build the dam, and the houses just moldered into ruins, basically. I read about that many years ago, and I was always taken by that idea of the government taking your house. But it sort of sat in the back of my mind for 20, 30 years, and it might have jogged my memory a little bit when I started this book. But I think really more than anything else, while I hope the water project in Miller's Valley reads as an authentic slice of life, it's more metaphoric in my mind. It's really a metaphor for how progress can obliterate the past.
Well, it's interesting because just this weekend they've announced that they're, you know, demolishing dams along the Klamath River that were built to, you know, make do all these things that are advertised in Miller's Valley about how it's going to be, you know, energy and help from flooding and, you know, provide recreation, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, now they're taking those dams down because they have to save the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me, too, that one of the things that's reflected in this novel is that originally it's a water project, but
right,
eventually it's a recreation project. And, of course, that sort of charts how the American economy has changed during our lifetime. We used to sort of do and make things, and now we do and make tourists.
Right, right. So we're going to have tourism as our income-producing thing.
Like now, so many other parts of the world.
Have you ever seen a bog turtle? You laugh.
Yes, I have.
Oh, good.
I'm not sure I'm allowed to tell you that, though.
Okay.
When they first told us that there were bog turtles on our property in Pennsylvania, it was very hush-hush because apparently very well-to-do Japanese businessmen like to collect. They're herpetology fans. They like to collect turtles, or at least this is what we were told. And therefore, we should keep the fact that we had this endangered bog turtle, who is now no longer endangered, perhaps partly thanks to us, a big secret. They're not very prepossessing, to be honest with you. They kind of look like those pet shop turtles, except that when they stick their neck out, they have these kind of, you know, lively red flames along the side.
Ours local thing is a salamander, which is protecting the Laguna de Santa Rosa from being built in, you know, houses. The fact that they would sink into the, you know, the morass when the rains came is completely coincidental, but that's what they used. Every place must have something like that,
I guess. And some of them, you realize, are well worth the effort. At our place in Pennsylvania, we have a pair of nesting bald eagles who frequently sit on the edge of our pond. And the efforts that we've put in to bring bald eagles back, every time I see one of ours, I think it was all worth it.
All worth it. Yeah. Wonderful. Tell me about Mimi Miller. Where she's an 11-year-old when we start the book. What more can you share?
Mimi is quite unlike me in a lot of ways. She's very practical, and she's a math science girl, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, a more imaginative English and poetry girl the way I was. She, in part, that's because she has a mother who's very practical and pragmatic, and has raised her so.
She is a nurse, the mother.
Her mother is a nurse, which is one of the only two jobs that, as far as Mimi can tell, women are permitted to do when she's a little girl, the other one being a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And
flight attendant. Didn't, was that a possibility?
It was, but I don't think that – that's not on Mimi's radar. She looks around her and – most of her teachers are female, and all of the nurses, and of course none of the doctors.
Right.
And as she grows up, the world begins to change for women, even in a small town like Miller's Valley. And the arc of her life charts those changes in the lives of women. Changes that she's in the beginning only dimly aware of, but that her mother certainly is very keen to embrace for her daughter. Her mother is not exactly a warm, fuzzy type, and I think that's because her mother doesn't want Mimi to get too comfortable, because if she's comfortable, she'll stay where she is.
Mm-hmm.
And Miriam Miller envisions a much bigger life on a much bigger stage for her little girl than that available in Miller's Valley.
Right. Well, the mother's a very strong-willed character.
Yes, absolutely.
And she's respected in the town in an odd way. She has no real identifiable, you know, she doesn't wear the I'm part of the city council kind of a thing. She does what she does. She's a nurse and the wife of a ostensibly a farmer, but actually a fix-it man for income. And but people still look up to her and expect her to say things, and often she chooses not to.
Well, I think most communities have at least one and often more than one woman like that.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who everyone knows does the right thing, considers options carefully, can be counted upon in certain kinds of situations. And so in some unofficial way becomes a kind of a town elder, if you will. And she's definitely that person in Miller's Valley.
Right, right. Her husband, on the other hand, is kind of a, well, he's married to the nurse kind of guy. He has his part to play, but it's not as important.
Yeah, but you know, you get a sense that he's somebody that everybody likes,
mm-hmm.
and that everybody can trust.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people bring their broken things to him to be fixed.
At a time when we actually repaired things instead of just threw them away.
Exactly, exactly. When, you know, when a toaster could actually be fixed to toast again as opposed to tossed into the trash and replaced with a new one from Target.
Can I stop you a second?
Sure.
Because when my dad died, we had one piece in the house that everybody, all the kids wanted, all the grandkids wanted. And it is the pullover sandwich maker, you know, that melts the cheese and grills the bread at the same time. And it's still working, and it was for a wedding gift in 1932. So they build things differently than they do now.
Well, I think that's true, and he's rebuilding things
right.
for people, which I think is an important role in the community. He's much more of a warm fuzzy type than she is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think if you look at the dynamic of that family, you know, he's the silk and she's the steel.
Right. But when the government man comes out, you know, drives up and hands out his business card, he wants to see the Mr., not the Mrs.
Well, but I think the assumption was always that the Mr. was the deed was in the Mr.'s name. The sale would be closed with the Mr. The Mr. was the guy who made the decisions. I
right.
mean, we're talking about 60 years ago. So, yeah, absolutely.
Right, right. Okay, well, we have to talk about Mimi's brother, Tommy. So can you open up to page 14 and read a little bit about him?
I'm always happy to talk about Tommy Miller.
Tommy is an interesting character in this
book.
He's just the first blue mark there.
He's
there
one
you
of
go.
My big faves.
It says start.
Ever since he'd finished high school, my brother had been at a loose end. At least that's what my Aunt Ruth called it, a loose end. It's not like school had been so great either. Unlike Eddie, who was class valedictorian, Tommy had always been a rotten student. Maybe he had one of those problems they didn't figure out until later, which I see now all the time, a learning disability or dyslexia or something. He had handwriting so bad that there was no one who could read it. Even he couldn't make it out sometimes. The only tests in high school where he had a fighting chance were true and false, although even there he occasionally made an F that looked too much like a T. He'd squeaked by, but at the time it didn't feel like it mattered much. When he strode across the gym and hoisted his diploma, the cheers were louder than they'd been at the end of the class president's speech. But then he was out in the world and found it hard to make a living with nothing but his easy ways. He would have been great at politics. Instead, he'd worked in a car repair place. But he lost his license for 6 months after he got popped on Main Street late one night speeding, with open beer cans in the car and a girl throwing up out the window. The police officer who stopped him was the father of the girl. And when he looked in the driver's side window, it was easy to see that his daughter wasn't wearing any pants. Tommy'd met the girl because her uncle owned the car repair place, so he was twice cursed. A lot of what Tommy got into seemed like a story someone was telling, except that it was true.
We can stop there. All right, tell me, where did Tommy come from? Is he this composite character of people you remember from high school or you remember with your own kids?
Again, I think the kind of great thing about writing fiction and the terrifying thing, too, is that over time, over days and months, they come out of nowhere. And it's like making sausage. You know, maybe there's some little piece of Tommy that somebody I once knew, and maybe there's some little piece that's like one of my brothers or cousins. But I don't really think of or believe in Tommy Miller that way. I believe in Tommy Miller as the guy I just described. He just is that person. And it's kind of wild because people say to you all the time when you're talking about your books, well, how did you make that choice? Right. How did you make the choice to make him the second kid? Or how did you make the choice to have Miriam be a nurse? Or how did you make the choice to have Mimi be good at math? And the truth is, and you don't want to sound too mystical about this because it makes you sound like an idiot, but you don't really feel like you made a choice. You feel like they just were who they are, and that at some level you're a stenographer or a ventriloquist. I was going on book tour once, and I was talking to E.L. Doctorow. Mm-hmm. And I said to Doctorow, I'm going out to do promotion. And he said, oh, poor you. Now you'll have to pretend that we know why we do what we do. And it made me feel so good that someone as hugely talented as Edgar Doctorow felt the same way that I did, which is that there's an essential mystery to this whole process, even to the people who are undertaking it.
So when you put your books together, I'm going to be on a very practical note. I like to use the post-it notes so I can move, you know, sections around. But again, characters just come to the writer. As you just said, sometimes, you know, you have no control. They know what they're going to do, and they're going to lead the story in a certain direction. So do you plan your stories in advance, or do your characters develop and it goes that way? In other words, did you have an ending when you started Miller's Valley?
I usually have an excellent idea of the beginning because mm-hmm. I've been thinking about it for months, and a general idea of the ending. Most of the hard work of a novel, at least for me, takes place in the middle mm-hmm. because it's where all the discovery is.
Right. And except for in this book where you really discover something quite amazing almost at the end.
Right. But the discovery for me about who these people really are and what's happening to them happens in the middle when suddenly I go – oh, my God. What happens to her the night before LaRonda's wedding?
Right.
I just got that. You know, sometimes you really sort of feel like you chance upon some of this stuff. And the truth is you can – look, I'm in charge. I can make the characters do whatever I want. But if the characters are doing and saying things that feel false to the essential nature you've created for them, then they're not characters at all. They're marionettes.
Right.
And the reader knows that. So it's when the reader says to you, Mimi was so real to me, you think, well, that was the point of the exercise.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people reading this, you know, these weeks that are saying, oh, I know her, or she was me, or that's my sister, or whatever, right?
That's exactly what you want. Because There's a great Robert Frost quote where he says, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader.
Right.
And I think of it every time I'm writing and I start to cry. There's part of me that thinks, yes! But the truth is, if they don't seem real to you, they're never going to seem real to the reader. And conversely, when you're in the middle of working on a novel and they and their houses and their town have come to seem in some ways more real to you than the real everyday world in which you're operating, then you're in good shape.
Good. So when you're missing the turnoff from the highway because you're plotting or thinking about what someone might say
or
as you're driving.
Or you see somebody crossing in front of your car and your first thought is, oh gosh, that's Buddy Miller. And then you realize that Buddy Miller exists only in your mind's eye at this point. That's
pretty
exciting.
But the Buddy Miller at the diner, you can see that person crossing the street.
Exactly.
Right? Yes, right. So we're going to do a little history here. We're going to talk about something that happens in the book. Won't give too much. I'm not purposely going to the last – well, I won't say that. We do see Stephen towards the end. But mostly I'm talking about the first, you know, middle part of the book because I don't want to give away too much.
Okay.
But if we – basically the Miller farm is in the lowest part of the valley. And one of the things you have to remind the reader of that is this – sump pump that turns on, and it's a very soothing sound or a very nerve-wracking sound if it sounds differently, right?
Exactly.
Right. So we're going to talk about the flood on page 32 because, indeed, a big, huge rainstorm comes and the flood, a minor flood, I guess we'll call it, happens. 32. There we go.
The water was deeper as I climbed back into the boat. And we sailed like a dream down our underwater driveway and onto what I knew was normally our road. It was hard to see much. No house lights, no street lights, no moon. What I could make out, it looked as though someone had mistakenly put an ordinary mid-sized lake in the middle of an area filled with things that had no business being there. The firefighter maneuvered the boat around power lines that came up suddenly like black snakes spitting and skittering along the surface, and pieces of things of roofs and fences and strange unidentifiable brown chunks that in the dark might be floating firewood or a drowned raccoon or a piece of someone's house. We stopped at the McAvoys, but they were already gone. And we floated past the Derwent's barn, where the cows were standing in the hayloft, mooing loudly. We helped Mr. and Mrs. Bascom into the boat, and they wanted to bring their shepherd dog, but the firefighter said we couldn't take the weight. The dog barked from inside the house. We picked up Mrs. Donovan, who lived alone and was on her front step holding an umbrella that was already in tatters from the wind. You could tell she was afraid, trying to step into the boat, and finally the firefighter took the umbrella out of her hand and laid it down carefully on the edge of her kitchen steps, as though she was going to be back to get it soon. He put out a hand to help her in, but she stumbled, and the boat rocked, and a little bit of water slopped in. Mr. and Mrs. Bascom both opened their mouths, but because of the rain I couldn't hear the sound they made. It was probably the same one I did, like a little goat noise.
Okay. What I think you've done on that page is describe the terror and fear and uncertainty and what on earth has happened to us mentality of someone who were in a natural disaster. And you know what I'm talking about when we see these things on television and they give this person 30 seconds and they have to be crying, you know, or they ask a leading question. So what do you think about your house 15 feet underwater, Mrs. So-and-so? And you just cringe because there's no – you don't know these people. You and in that little vignette, you do.
Well,
and I love
you.
The way you put the umbrella back on
thank
the
you.
Step.
Thank you so much.
Right. So it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Okay. But in the same thing, they end up at the hall where Mr. Venti is going to make some chipped beef on toast. So page 35.
Chipped beef on toast, man. Nobody eats chipped beef on toast.
You know,
toast
my mother
anymore.
Used to make chipped beef on toast.
And seriously. Welsh rarebit, right?
Well, no. She'd basically take a can of mushroom soup and put the dried chipped beef out of the glass jar, remember?
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, gosh. So here we are.
Mimi's best friend is named LaRonda.
Thank you.
LaRonda's father and mother were setting up the big steel dishes they used at the restaurant for wedding receptions and christening parties. LaRonda's father let me and LaRonda light the little candles underneath that kept the chipped beef and the mashed potatoes warm. "Who eats chipped beef?" LaRonda said. "I like chipped beef," Donald said, just like I knew he would. He and LaRonda, oil and water, as my mother liked to say. The older men were already digging in, ladling chipped beef on slices of toast. "There's more where that came from," Mr. Venti said to each one. Everyone was suspicious of him. He'd blown into town after the Second World War to visit a buddy and just stayed on. "Like he fell from the sky," Donald's grandfather liked to say, shaking his head as though the sky was a bad place to be from. Besides, there weren't any other Italians in Miller's Valley. There weren't really any new immigrants in Miller's Valley at all. You could tell by their last names that people who lived in the area were originally from Germany or Poland or some of the Slavic countries, but they'd been Americans long enough to have flat vowels and made-up minds. When I got older, I realized that the majority of people in Miller's Valley were the most discontented kind of Americans, working people whose situations hadn't risen or fallen over generations, but who still carried a little bit of those streets paved with gold illusions, and so were always annoyed that the streets were paved with tar, if they were paved at all.
Okay, I read that and then immediately took me to the presidential nominees.
I bet it did.
Yes. So there's this, we keep being told that some of the anger that is felt by the people who are primarily voting for Trump, to make it simple, feel that the world has left them, they've gone forward and they've been somehow left behind. And that's kind of what you're describing as the people in this town. They're really suspicious of the misery. He's been there, what, now 30 years or something mm-hmm. like that? Yeah. But he's still a newcomer, will always be a newcomer, and he has a vowel at the end of his name. Right. And he runs the Italian restaurant and he's doing well enough to build this huge house with the pillars in the front, even though it's a ranch style house. And everybody's just a little bit jealous about that.
Exactly.
Right. So do you want to comment about what's happening in America today? We'll talk about the last 6 months.
Sure. I think there are always significant groups of people in America who feel like somebody did them a dirty, mm-hmm. that they expected to wake up on third base thinking they'd hit a triple, and that just hasn't happened for them. And I think it's always been true that the people who get blamed are newcomers, mm-hmm. whether they're newcomers to the town or newcomers to the country. That's why we're currently demonizing immigrants.
Right.
Look, I'm the granddaughter of Italian immigrants, and I grew up on stories from my mother, who was a very gentle, sweet-tempered person and rarely complained about anything. But one of the few things I ever saw her get lit about was being called a WOP mm-hmm. or a Dago.
Right.
And I grew up with this idea that lovely people had terrible hurt feelings based on being demonized for nothing more than their country of origin. So I couldn't get on that particular bus. But I think that's been a strain that has been in our history forever. The reason that we reinvent it every generation or two is because Americans reinvent everything. You know, we forget the lessons of World War II. We forget the lessons of Vietnam. We blunder into Iraq. We go to Kuwait. I think it's because we're such an adolescent country compared to the rest of the world that we have amnesia all the time. Mm-hmm. We learn really profound lessons from the past, and then we promptly paper them over. And that's part of what this novel is about.
Right. Well, it's definitely about that because it's in the 60s, which is probably, at least as far as I'm aware, the most tumultuous non-wartime, except it is a wartime. But it's a wartime that's sort of over there, except you know people who are over there and we're not coming back.
And you know people who are over there, but you have no idea where over there is.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the jungles.
I mean, I remember the first time that I started hearing about friends of mine at the beginning of the 21st century who were going to Vietnam on vacation.
Right.
And
it
was kind of shocking because everything associated with going to Vietnam in our childhood and young adulthood was negative. It was as though you were going to be trapped there.
Right. You remember the scene in Apocalypse Now where they're surfing the beach and the bombs, you know, start appearing. But it is – my daughter was just there last year and she said it's a truly beautiful place. And it's just – but just beneath the surface and just around the corner are the remnants of what happened.
Exactly.
However, the people there have forgotten and moved on intentionally. And they're welcoming to, you know, tourists and the dollars that come and the trial to understand what it was all about. Is going on constantly. But let's get back to Miller's Valley. We could talk about this for the, you know, the entire show.
We sure could. We could talk about the presidential race for the whole show.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's we've had the this we'll call it the small flood, right? And we've talked about the Chiff beef. And, of course, you've got to clean up. So let's go into page 38. Okay? You're already there. You're ahead of me. And there's something that's interesting that's going to happen here, and I love how you have – I love how the words have come together since apparently it's a mystical activity, right, to make these two quite diverse things happen at the same time. Mm. So let's start there. We're cleaning up.
My parents didn't drown. Donald's grandfather didn't drown either. His grandmother did. I'll remember that date for the rest of my life, August 21st, 1966, the day Donald's grandmother died and the day my brother Tommy enlisted in the Marines. In a damn canoe, my mother said when my father picked me up and brought me home from LaRonda's house. That's how I knew it was bad, because my mother swore in front of me. A damned canoe. A goddamn canoe. Even then I could tell that her anger was a mirror of her love. She loved Tommy so, and so did I, and my father did too, although it was more complicated with the two of them. Everybody else liked him a lot, mainly in spite of themselves, except maybe the fathers of the girls he dated. He was good-looking, LaRonda was right about that, but it was more the vitality of him, like a combination of heat and light he gave off. Once I had to find him in the school hallways when I'd missed the bus and had no way of getting home, and all I had to do was look for a big clot of kids in front of the lockers. There he was, right at the center. "Hey, corncob," he'd said, not denying me like most teenage brothers would, and the girls in the group smiled stupidly. "He's even sweet to his sister," they were thinking. "She's something, isn't he?" he added, looking around, then making a pistol of his finger and pointing it at one of the boys. "Hey!" A brother warning. No boy had so much as looked at me twice at that point except to ask to copy my math homework, and Tommy in the high school hallway was acting as though I was hot stuff. When my mother finally spit out the story in fits and starts, fits being the right word because she was ready to have one, I could just see Tommy in a borrowed canoe pushing the oars through the murky floodwaters as his biceps knotted and smoothed out along with the motion. By the time he got to the house, the rain had slowed down, and my parents were looking over the flood insurance policy, which my mother always kept in the top drawer of her bedside table. Tommy had steered the canoe right into the hallway and left it there while he went upstairs to sleep. In the morning, the canoe was sitting on the hall runner, and the runner was sitting on about 3 inches of silt. If my mother had been a different sort of person, she would have cried. It probably wasn't the best time for Tommy to say that he'd enlisted. No coffee, no breakfast, two dead cows listed over like spotted dirigibles in the middle of the road. "I joined the Marines," he said, as he and my father looped a length of chain around a cow and towed it off to the side of the barn with the truck. "So he wasn't really in the canoe when he told you?" I said. "My God, Mary Margaret, what does that have to do with anything?" my mother said as she scrubbed at the dirt on her lower kitchen cabinets and tossed me a sponge.
Right. We're going to take a break. You are listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB-FM. Today's guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, best-selling novelist, and social commentator, and quite enjoyable raconteur, Anna Quinlan, reading from her newest novel, Miller's Valley. Anna will be chatting about some of the themes in her popular columns during the next half hour, so stay tuned to KRCB-FM. Okay, so we've had the flood, and Tommy has announced his going to the Marines, which of course means at this time in 1966, almost inevitably, that he's going to go to Vietnam.
Something that he has no clue about.
No clue about.
No, I mean, he's done this so fecklessly and just off the top of his head that – and let's face it, 1966 in a small town like Miller's Valley, the idea that troops were going to Vietnam hadn't really filtered down. I mean, this wasn't 68 or 69.
It wasn't when there on was the news
the build,
yet.
Yeah. When there was the buildup.
Right, right. So – it was one of those things where we were there for just a short time and we were certainly going to show those other people, you know, that we were the big, strong, powerful. And the fact that they would fight with bamboo sticks and, you know, was beyond our ken.
We were going to stop communism in its tracks.
Right. The domino theory.
The domino theory, exactly.
Boy, we believed it too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Americans can talk themselves into a lot of stuff.
Well, Tommy is a character that I obviously enjoy because I keep coming back to him.
He's my favorite character
in
the book. Oh,
yours too?
I just love him. Yeah. I love him. I want all good things for him, and I bleed for him when that's not how it turns out.
Well, the fun thing is how, you know, there's a little bit we've already read about that, about how protective he is of his sister.
Right.
But he offers her sage advice as well. He says, basically, you're bigger than this place.
Right.
Yeah. Which your mother has been saying, but she hasn't been hearing it from her.
You got to get out. But I mean, look, I mean, the other thing this novel is about, it's about home.
Right.
You know, the quote from James Baldwin at the beginning that home isn't a place, it's an irrevocable condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to leave home. And even if you leave, as Mimi says, you don't ever really leave. It lives inside of you. But certainly for a girl from her kind of background, from a family that's lived in the same place, on the same farm for generations, the idea of leaving is not only terrifying, it's kind of preposterous.
But I think to Tommy, it's just what he has to do, leaving.
Well, he's got to come up with a plan B. You know, he's one of those guys who has such easy charm and everybody loves him. But charm without drive doesn't get you anywhere. And he just needs to find – he needs to find a place. He needs to find a job. And the service seems to him, after he's burned a couple of bridges in Miller's Valley, mm-hmm. like the way to go. Mm-hmm. Or at least we think so. We only see this from Mimi's point of view because the novel's written in the first person. And – you know, for all we know, Tommy got drunk and did this on a dare, because that's certainly something that you could imagine him doing.
Yeah, but there aren't others of his buddies that are doing it at the same time that we know about.
Exactly.
Right. Well, let's hear a little bit more about Tommy, a little bit further on, page 73, when a young woman named Callie appears at the – well, you read it. Okay.
Tom hadn't been overseas for long when an old friend of my father's named Pete Fenstermach showed up at our house in his truck. He'd pulled into the driveway with a sound from his tires that didn't look good for the visit, had gone around to the passenger side and pulled his 17-year-old daughter from the cab by her arm. It was January, but she wasn't wearing a coat, just a big old man's shirt and a pair of jeans underneath. She tried to pull away, but her father was stronger than she was. I knew her to say hi to. She was a couple of years ahead of me at school, the kind of girl, pale and big-eyed and thin, who looked pretty sometimes and other times just looked plain. It took me a minute to remember that her name was Callie. "Daddy," I said. Mr. Fenstermach and Callie came in through the back door into the kitchen. My mother put her hands on her hips and looked the girl up and down as though she knew just what she was looking for. Mm-hmm. And then she sat down hard in one of our kitchen chairs. She put up her hand as Mr. Fenstermach, red in the face, started to open his mouth. "Pete," my mother said in a way that shut him right up, and then to Callie, "how far along are you?" I remember I leaned so hard against the refrigerator that I could feel it humming through the backs of my legs. "Go see your aunt," my father said. "No," my mother and I said at the same time. "6 months," said Callie. "You know who did this to her?" her father shouted. "Don't be ridiculous," my mother said. "You wouldn't be here if it was anybody but my Tom." My Tom. My mother never called me her Mimi, or called my brother her Eddie. It was always her Tom. I couldn't even argue with it. He was my Tom, too. Since he'd left, the house had seemed like a baby's rattle with all the jingly things inside gone. "He's got to marry her." "I hear what you're saying, but he's over in Asia someplace, and we don't even know when he's coming back or whether the mail's getting through to him." "You get him back here," yelled Mr. Fenstermach. "I'll go over there and drag him back here myself." Callie whispered something. "What's that?" my mother said. "I'm not marrying anyone," she said. "You're not planning on giving this baby away to strangers, are you?" my mother said. Callie shook her head. "I can handle it," she said. And quiet as it was, she said it in this kind of voice that made me believe her. The men argued some, but my mother kept quiet, and Callie wouldn't budge. And then it was all over, or just beginning. I got the impression that my mother had known long before that afternoon. She was discreet, my mother. She had to be. You can't be a nurse in a small-town hospital, know who has a crooked spine and who has a killing cancer and whose hysterectomy is because she used a Lysol douche to try to keep from having an eighth child in 10 years, and not be the kind of person who can keep a secret. My mother had two texts on the wall of her bedroom in gilded frames, the Lord's Prayer and the Florence Nightingale Oath. "Hold in confidence," it says about a nurse's obligation. It was never my mother who gave things away. It was the looks on other people's faces when they saw her. I had a fifth-grade teacher who I could tell my mother didn't like and who didn't like her. And it wasn't until the week my mother died, when I was telling her stories to take her mind off the pain in her gut, that she said to me, "That Mrs. Prentice, she beat her boy. I was sure of it. She or her husband. But I couldn't prove a thing." I don't think she would have told me even then if both the Prentices hadn't been dead and their son living somewhere out west. I remembered the wary look Mrs. Prentice had had those few times my mother had come to school. Callie gave my mother a look that day, but it was more an exchange of understanding, and that's what they came to. Callie was going to need help, and my mother wanted a hand in the raising of her grandchild. I think my mother kind of admired Callie, admired her nerve, admired her determination to keep her kid at a time when a pregnant teenage girl either got married or gave her baby away. But it made her start watching me even more than she normally did. She needn't have worried. Every time I thought of what Tommy and Callie had done, it gave me a funny feeling and not a good one. I liked kissing, and even then some, although I'd done very little of it, mostly in the hallway at Mixers with a boy from my homeroom named John Gellhorn, who said, "Wow," each time we came up for air. But what came after just seemed strange to me. And Callie and Tommy were such a mismatch, him all fireworks and her so not.
Okay, which one of these things do we want to talk about? The 1960s morality, the assumptions that were made in small towns, the hormones of teenagers?
The hormones of teenagers.
Okay, we'll pick that one up.
Well, yeah, but what followed was so sad. I mean, I read books about, well, now grown women who gave away their children mm-hmm. when they were teenagers, mm-hmm. who were forced to give away their children and to not ever see them again or find them after 30 or 40 or 50 years when their children might or might not want to have anything to do with them. And I just think, why? Why did we do that to people? Why did we punish them in that way? Why did we punish the girls? Why did we punish the kids? You know, there are some downsides to the changes we've made and the way we behave now. But all in all, I just think it's so much better and so much healthier for everyone involved than what we did then.
Well, there were whole institutions that were set up to make sure that there was a line of adoptable children. I mean, you know, you've left the Catholic Church.
Right.
And that was one of their income-producing activities.
And to make sure that the young women involved felt as much shame and self-hatred as possible.
Right.
I don't know how those women ever came back from that.
Some didn't.
I know. Some definitely didn't. It's mind-boggling to me that we did this to our daughters, to our sisters, that we disappeared them and then made them come back utterly changed in ways that they could never acknowledge or discuss.
Right, right. Well, I'm going to shift a little bit here. We're going to go to one of the essays you wrote for Newsweek as a column. And it's about mothering and the fact that your kids – I don't know when this is written. I don't have a date on this. And if you could just read this from the biggest mistake. And this is about your own kids who are now grown up when you've
written
that.
I can't believe you're asking me to read this because, I mean, let's face it, making it through this is a toughie.
It is. It is. And then, you know, and the toughest is those teenage years. And all of a sudden they turned, I don't know, 21
no,
or 20.
No, no. I mean making it through reading this for me.
Is that
just,
hard? If you want to not, we can not.
No, no. It's okay. I mean this.
You know why I picked
it. It's really interesting for me because I probably wrote this maybe 12 or 14 years ago.
Well, you can sort of tell by – here's the first paragraph.
It shows
the ages of the kids.
Yeah. It gets recycled every year on Mother's Day.
Right.
And women come up to me and say, "I loved that Mother's Day piece that you wrote." And when they would first say it, I would think, I haven't written a Mother's Day piece in a couple of years. And then I realized it was the power of the internet to make things kind of evergreen in a way.
Kind of reappears. Yeah.
The biggest mistake I made is the one that most of us make while doing this. I did not live in the moment enough. This is particularly clear now that the moment is gone, captured only in photographs. There is one picture of the three of them sitting in the grass on a quilt in the shadow of the swing set on a summer day ages 6, 4, and 1. And I wish I could remember what we ate and what we talked about and how they sounded and how they looked when they slept that night. I wish I had not been in such a hurry to get on to the next thing. Dinner, bath, book, bed. I wish I had treasured the doing a little more and the getting it done a little less. Even today, I'm not sure what worked and what didn't, what was me and what was simply life. When they were very small, I suppose I thought someday they would become who they were because of what I'd done. Now I suspect they simply grew into their true selves because they demanded in a thousand ways that I back off and let them be. The books said to be relaxed, and I was often tense, matter of fact, and I was sometimes over the top. And look how it all turned out. I wound up with the three people I like best in the world who have done more than anyone to excavate my essential humanity. That's what the books never told me. I was bound and determined to learn from the experts. It just took me a while to figure out who the experts were.
And who are the experts?
My kids.
Yes, our kids. Oh, dear. I couldn't read that without turning to something else, which appeared when I was looking up stuff about you. You got a lot of stuff on. This is all good.
You can't ever Google yourself. That way lies disaster.
You have more pages than I can possibly believe out there.
Although I spent years trying to convince Wikipedia that I was born in 1952 and not 1953. Every time I got them to try to fix it, they would send me this notice saying, "We cannot take your word for this because we have a sense that you have some sort of stake in the outcome of this." You know, as though I was trying to spin something. And I was like, okay, I'm a 63-year-old woman trying to convince you that I'm not 62. Give me a break here.
It's funny how many people have things that they have to figure out some – because you can't change it yourself. It has to be one of the approved editors who
exactly.
does.
Exactly. Yeah, so. I finally persuaded them.
Good. So it is 1952?
It's 1952,
It's good year.
And people would say to me, why do you want to make yourself a year older? I'd say, I spent the best years of my life as a reporter, which means the facts have to be correct, and the facts are incorrect.
Right. Well, there's this little, time shift. No. All right. In a Huffington Post interview, you have this phrase. Job one for me was raising feminist sons. Unless men come along for the ride, you'll be left with all the stuff women were obliged to do 100 years ago or 40 years ago because the men haven't changed as well.
It's absolutely true. And I am happy to say that I was successful in that. And as Christopher Crovaton once said to me when I was patting myself on the back about the fact that he was a feminist, yeah, Mom, chicks dig it. And it turns out that's true.
That's true.
Chicks dig being with guys who treat them as equals.
or even better. Right. Women are amazing, truly amazing.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Someone asked me the other day, why are the protagonists in most of your books female? And I said, because I find women more interesting than men.
Let me think about that. My books. That's true, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are. There's so many layers.
And you get more of a sense of the fabric of life because women are usually weaving the fabric of life. So you get that kind of deep dive into what's going on.
Yeah, well, you have to be quilting the fabric of life because my wife's a quilter.
And I am a needle pointer.
Okay, that works too.
You think to yourself, how would this book be different if instead of being told by Mimi Miller, it was being told by Tommy Miller.
Oh, wow.
And I just don't think Tommy understands enough about himself or why he does what he does to be the narrator of this story.
He's not empathetic enough.
Yeah, well, and he's not self-aware enough.
Right. But his younger sister is already.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Good book. All right. We don't have actually a lot of time left, but I do want to have you read one more thing. Because Mimi goes off and, you know, does grow up, and all of a sudden things happen. And it's what I call Stephen and Mimi. It's on page 118. You want to share that with us?
I can't believe I'm reading this.
Is that okay?
I'm sure my kids can't believe I wrote this.
Do you
this.
Mind that I picked
no,
that?
No, no,
I, mean,
I don't.
You know why I picked out
it just
these
reminds.
Sections.
It just reminds me of when they were young and Christopher was very nervous about reading my work because he said to Quinn in a whisper, "What if I don't like it? Oh. What will I say?"
Oh.
And Quinn said, "No, Christopher, you'll like it, except for the sex scene." And Christopher, I heard Christopher say, "Mom wrote a sex scene."
More than one.
This is about Stephen, who Mimi has her first serious relationship with. "For the rest of my life, he would always be the guy who first French kissed me, who first felt me up, who first put his hands down my jeans, who first took my virginity. Now, that's not true. He didn't take it. I gave it to him. I shoved it at him with both hands. There was a routine the girls went through in high school, and I'd heard about it often enough to know how it went. I'd heard it once spelled out like a science experiment to a whole bench full of girls in their underwear after gym by a girl named Nancy Fuller. 'You don't let him put his tongue in your mouth for at least 4 dates,' she said, adjusting her breasts inside her bra to make sure they were even. 'You wait at least 3 months before you let him get under the shirt. If he's really your boyfriend, you can let him go below the waist, but that's it. And don't ever take your clothes off because he won't be able to stop.' When the time came, I felt like Nancy had missed an important part of the whole deal. I couldn't wait to get my clothes off. I would have died if he'd stopped. I don't know why I wasn't embarrassed or ashamed or sorry, but I wasn't. Sometimes I thought there was something wrong with me, that I was just bad, or I'd better stay with one guy because if they let me loose, there's no telling what I'd do. Mostly I thought it was because Stephen was so damn charming. He wore charm like a 3-piece suit. He knew his way around a girl."
Right. Okay. Well, but it's interesting. You have this one little vignette, and I'm a remodeler and, you know, home do-it-yourselfer kind of thing. And she happens to go back to a house that he's remodeled and discovers that instead of 16-inch on center, everyone who builds a wall knows you need to separate it out because that makes 4 feet for the panel to go up. So instead of 16-inch on center, he'd use 2 feet. Now, that meant that in a wall, he saved at that time about $15, $16 in studs that he didn't have to put in. That's all.
But what it really means is that Stephen is a real Sharpie.
He is a Sharpie.
Putting the studs too far apart is just a measure of all the other things where he's going to cut
corners.
And it's,
of course, that's exactly it. He's a guy who cuts corners.
Yeah.
Yes. And that catches him up at the end, and she finally, well, figures it all out.
Right.
I don't want to give too much away.
Right.
It's too much fun in the scene that you, unless you want to read that.
But the kind of guy who's a Sharpie when you're 16 years old is kind of irresistible, particularly if you're somebody who has a brother who's really charming but not really a Sharpie. Tommy isn't that guy. He's not a bad guy. Tommy's a good guy at some level. And if you sort of are – you're not a Sharpie yourself. You know, Mimi's best friend on and off is LaRonda, who really knows how to play the angles in every conceivable way. And so when Mimi meets Stephen, he's kind of that irresistible force that she doesn't even begin to understand and that quite frankly inspires lust of a sort that overrides all of your other good impulses.
Right. All right. I'm going to take you to 219, the last visit with Stephen. Is that okay?
As long as we don't give anything away. That's
well, I don't know. Think this one you're going to have to skip those parts.
Oh, you've
in the
got
middle.
A lot. I wish the audience could see all these little blue post-it things of you because there's like start and then there's skip, start again.
Well, it's for time, right? Uh-huh. Sure.
"It's a creepy feeling walking in on someone having sex. It's even creepier when it's someone you thought was only having sex with you.
I turned and went out the back door and walked around the side of the house to the little borrowed blue Volkswagen at the curb. It had a plastic flower around the radio antenna, a pink daisy. Basically, that's all you needed to know about the girl who'd lent it to me. "Whoa, babe, whoa," I heard Stephen yell from inside the house, and then I heard a girl's voice say, "What?" That's what got to me as much as the sex part, the babe part. A guy who calls more than one woman babe is a guy you don't want to have any part of, even when he comes running out to the car to stop you from leaving in just a pair of jeans and bare feet. I turned the car on and he yanked open the passenger side door. "Don't get in this car," I said. Behind him at the front door, I could see the girl in nothing but a big T-shirt. "Who is it?" she yelled. "His former girlfriend," I yelled back. "Oh, Jesus Christ," said Stephen. "My feet are freezing. Let me just sit in the car for a minute." "No, I'm leaving now. I'm here looking for Tommy. Some guy came to our house and threatened my aunt. So just tell me what you know about Tommy and I will leave and you can get back to business." "It's not what it looks like," he said. When he saw my expression, he shut up about that. "I love you," he yelled as I drove away. He meant it, too. I knew him. I knew he meant it. Just like I knew he went back inside and finished what he'd started with what's-her-name. Probably more than once. Charm is like tinsel without the tree. What's tinsel without the tree? Shredded tinfoil.
Ah. I read your columnist point of view in that paragraph, right?
Yeah.
You got to have a little.
Yeah, well, my columnist point – I mean, honestly, I don't really have a columnist point of view. What I have is me. Right. I mean, that's what I bring to every table, and here we are.
Right. Okay, you have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB-FM. Today's guest has been the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, best-selling novelist, and social commentator Anna Quinlan, who shared excerpts from her columns and her newest novel, Miller's Valley. Our studio engineer for today's show is Jesse Van Cushion. The KRCB program manager is Sean Knight. Our radio assistant is Wendy Nicholson. Our theme music is by Bill Conti. And I am your host, Gil Manser. We invite you to join us for our June Word by Word broadcast from 4 to 5 on Sunday afternoon, June 12th, when our guest will be the talented graphic novelist and cartoonist Maya Kobabi and Trinidad Escobar. Until then, have a great time.